Good evening, everyone. My name's Snooky Simon, and I'm an alcoholic. I appreciate that very nice introduction, Groves. That's something I probably didn't deserve, too. Like, I do not deserve so many things. You know, being asked to even come here tonight was quite an honor, and I appreciate it. I appreciate being with you people. But in milling around today, I began to feel inadequate, I guess is the best expression, because I was talking with so many people who have probably forgotten more about AA than I'll ever learn. But the mere fact that you've asked me to come and be with you tonight, to me, presents quite an honor. Joe was telling me out in the hallway there this afternoon, he said, I'll get with you in a few minutes and tell you what to say. I told him it's too late, I'd already talked to my wife. One of the first things you taught me when I came into this program a few 24 hours ago was get cocky. So this coach got to go. And any of you who feel uncomfortable, get comfortable.
How far?
Before I do get started, I had one announcement here I needed to make from the hotel. There's a 79 Volkswagen color white out here next to the entrance. License number is DWU38726-4HAP32. Now the car is all right, but your license plate's blocking the drive. You know, when you park your car like that, you can always figure something's going to happen. You can always tell when bad days come along, anyway. I sort of felt like this morning I was beginning to have one. I started out at the hospital to pick up some things I promised Groves I'd get to him 4 months ago when heavy. There was a train coming across the track, 322 cars, is what I counted. Get to the hospital, and we had a lady who'd come off the night shift who has an outstanding command of the English language. And she produced all this verbiage at one time on me while I was trying to get out of my office. When I started back home, another train. Coming from the other way. And here I was pushing time, trying to get out of Rome and shoot over Jim Bennett's house so we can get to Rome. That's why I say you always know when it may be something, maybe starting out to be a bad day. And there's several ways you can tell when this is coming about, so you can really do something about it. You can tell it's going to be a bad day when you get up in the morning, call suicide prevention, and they put you on hold. It's a great start. Another way is that when your birthday cake collapses just from the weight of the candles. Good indicator. Another is when your twin sister forgets that it's your birthday. A lot of ways. Or when you get up in the morning and decide to wear the same clothes that you wore last night and they aren't there. That's always a bad day. Or maybe when you get to the office and you find that the 60-minute news team is already set up for you when you walk in the door. And for you ladies, you can remember this and count on it always. It's going to be a bad day when you get up in the morning, put your bra on backwards, and it fits better. That you can bank on. Lady out in the hallway, talking just before we came in, and said, aren't you nervous? I said, no, I'm sort of like Father Martin said on the Alcoholism and Family tape. Don't get nervous, it's called stark terror. As I said, I'm an alcoholic. I work for the Department of Human Resources. I'm assigned to Northwest Georgia Regional Hospital in the Alcohol and Drug Treatment Unit. I work as a counselor, case manager, as a treatment coordinator, also as the director of patient education on that unit. My husband, father, a fairly respected member of my community, but above all, and before I can be any or even one of these things, I must always remember first that I am an alcoholic, that my life became unmanageable. I suffer from the same terminal illness that many of you suffer from. I know the pain, I know the torment, I know the mental anxiety, and I know the living hell that we've all been through. I've experienced that pain of alcohol withdrawal, the confusion of the mind, the feeling of complete deprivation, and the terrifying agony that comes when you finally admit that your life is really unmanageable. It's that helpless sensation of knowing that at last you have failed. Absolutely. Alcohol can and did produce this and many more problems in my life. I dwelled in that bottomless pit of alcoholism. 15 long years. Miserable years. I was somewhat like the laboratory mouse put in the test maze, running in every direction trying to find a way out, not really knowing which way to go, feeling the frustration of going the wrong way, starting over, getting down, getting out, to the point of not really caring, not really knowing where I was going and not caring where I was going, not knowing how to get out of this terrifying experience that I found myself in. I really became the victim of an insidious disease. And I think the worst part of it was I didn't realize I was sick. A terminal illness and not realizing that you're sick was frightening. You know, in those days, I had heard that AA existed. But that's about all I heard. I had two conceptions of it. It was an outfit that sold books, or it was just a bunch of old drunks getting together to tell their stories. And I wasn't really interested in either one. So in those times, I guess I had my own 12 steps. Now, I didn't have any traditions, and every promise I made was empty. But I did live by some rules, if you want to call them that. And I tried to paraphrase them. They're not like our 12 steps, but they were mine. Number one, I decided I could handle alcohol if other people would just stop running my life. Number two, I firmly believed that there was no greater power than myself, and that anyone who disagreed with me had to be insane. Three, I made a decision to remove my will and my life from the care of God, because he didn't understand me anyway. Four, I made a searching and fearless moral inventory of everyone I knew, and made sure that they didn't take advantage of my good nature. Five, I sought these people out, and I tried to get them to admit to me the exact nature of their wrong. And number six, I became willing to help these people to get rid of all these shameful defects of character. Seven, I became humble enough to ask these people to remove their shortcomings. Eight, I made a list of all persons who had harmed me and waited very impatiently to get even with them. Number nine, I got even with these people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure me further. Number 10, I continued to take everyone's inventory, and when they were wrong, which was most of the time, I promptly asked them to admit it to me. 11, I sought through concentration and conniving to get God, who didn't understand me still yet, to see that my ideas were actually superb thoughts, and that he should give me the power to carry all of them out. And number 12, having maintained this drunken stupor for 15 years, I can thoroughly recommend it to anyone who wants to maintain his status as a drunk and practice these principles in all his affairs. I can highly recommend those 12 steps to you if you do not have a desire to enter a new life. We call our group in Rome the New Life Group because we feel like that's just it. Talking to Vaughn this afternoon, he and I got together and started this group up be 2 years ago, the 18th of July. Vaughn. And it's grown from three outside people with a small patient load at that time, up to where we have anywhere from 65 to 70 people weekly. We're very proud of our group. In fact, we've got the best group in the world. Now, I was up in the 15th district here visiting with Roy and some of the folks here not too long ago, and I heard it said that if you don't have the best group there is, you're in the wrong group. Well, as the talk went around the breakfast table that morning, the first statement was, we have the best group in Whitfield County. The second one was, we've got the best group in Whitfield, Catoosa, and Walker counties. The third one was, we've got the best group in the tri-state area. Then the last one, and that's where I tuned out, he said, we've got the best group in the cosmos. I knew then we had a lot more work to do in our little group. To qualify my being here, I think there are a few things that you need to know about me. I was born and raised in Rome, and not unlike so many of you here, I had what I consider to be an average childhood. My father died when I was young. Mother made an adequate living to support us. But in glancing back, I think that something was happening to me that added to the addictive process later in life. We lived in an area where there were two facilities. There was a church directly across the street from us. Next door to that was what we call the Maple Street Community Center, a recreation center. Learned to play basketball, tennis, all the games that children learn to play. But at that time, I found that maybe I had to try just a little harder than the average person to achieve the same goal. If we were in the woodcraft shop and somebody made something beautiful in 15 minutes, maybe it took me 2 hours and it wasn't quite as nice then. So I found myself in this drive to achieve, to get the best and be the best. And in doing so, I had to push myself and still never felt like I was getting there. Now, this is one feeling that was developed during those early years. The second influence was the Maple Street Baptist Church, directly across the street from the house. When the doors opened, Mother made sure that we were there. Front row center. This was of the Pentecostal, old-fashioned Southern Baptist Convention type church, where the God of fear was preached. God was going to strike you dead if you did this. He was going to punish you if you didn't do that. And it was not after you folks introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I found that God is not. I did not know that God was the higher power of understanding, love, and affection. But these are two powers that were affecting my life that early. Drive to achieve fear of spirituality or organized religion. My childhood was rather uneventful. I got by in school. Went on to college. Studied journalism. Played basketball. And it was during this time that I had my first experience with alcohol. Which stayed on campus one weekend to play a basketball game. And I tell you how much I remember about the game. I don't know who we played or whether we won or lost. That's how much I remember about that. But what really sticks out in my mind is this. After the game, we returned to the dormitory. Somebody came in with a big wash tub, ice down, full of beer. I had never tasted alcohol. Peer pressure being what it was then and what it still is today, I joined the crowd. Well, needless to say, the next morning I woke up with my head hurting. I was nauseated, the awfulest thing that ever happened to me and all this good sort of stuff. But in the back of my mind was something even more fearful. Our coach was named Dr. Charles B. Clark. Dr. Clark came directly to West Georgia from Parris Island, South Carolina, retiring out of the Marine Corps as physical education director. Now, alcohol to Dr. Clark would be sort of like slapping his grandmother in the face. It'd be like burning the American flag. And the only thing I could think of on that day I felt so bad was, what if Dr. Clark finds out we've been drinking beer? We will have had to lick. You know, I respected that man, but he absolutely terrified me. I went to practice that next day. You know, usually after a game, you go in and limber up. Work out a little bit, going back to the dormitory. On this particular day, we walked in. Dr. Clark was there, dressed out in his gym clothes. We started out with 50 laps around the gym. We did 2.5 hours of calisthenics and 1-to-1 drills. And then the unusual happened. The bus had broken down and we had to run 2 miles back to the dormitory. He never mentioned a beer. But we got the message, believe me. But this was, as we call it in the treatment process, experimentation. I was not an addictive drinker at that one moment. In fact, I didn't like the stuff. I didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't like the way I felt afterwards. And I wasn't going through that terrifying experience with Dr. Clark again. That I had made up my mind. After leaving college, I went to work on the Rome News Tribune. And it was here that I came in contact with my first real, live, full, red-blooded American alcoholic. He was our city editor and one of the finest newspaper men I ever knew. I walked back in from lunch one day. Telephone man was working in the newsroom, which really wasn't all that unusual. I sat down and started tapping, and I suddenly realized that this telephone man was disconnecting telephones. So when I asked him what he was up to, he said, "Well, I have an order here from the city editor to remove all phones from the newsroom." While I was still pondering what was going on, the city editor came back in from lunch. I walked over and started talking to him. I said, "We cannot take phones out of a newsroom. That's unheard of." He said, "Oh, but you haven't heard the latest. There's such a thing as two-way radios, and this is the wave of the future. We're going to two-way radios all the way in our news coverage." I said, "Well, that's going to be great for us. Very nice convenience item, but how about all those people that we serve each day? How are they going to call us?" He leaned back in his chair and said, "That's their problem." The next morning, he went to Murfreesboro, Tennessee, to the VA hospital there. I wish I could say that was the trip that got Barney on the right track. However, I cannot say that because Barney died about 5 years ago in Korsakoff syndrome, what we call wet brain. It was a pathetic story, but that was my first contact with a real live alcoholic. We've got an emergency phone call here for Jim Grantham from Warner Robins. Jim? You know, the newspaper industry in those days was very reflective of what you've seen as the image personified by television and movies. Hard drinking, hard playing, and hard working people. Hard drinking always coming first. And it was at this point that more contact with alcohol began to enter my life, because I was with it day to day. Still no problem. Still the social drinker who could take one and go on about his business. Still the one who had to operate the newsroom when the rest of them wasn't able to come in. But slowly and gradually, I was working my way into the realm of some type of daily drinking. Well, that then went into radio. In radio, the unwritten rule is no alcohol if you're going on a microphone. I proceeded to rewrite that rule. And I know at one time they took me off the air one night simply because I couldn't say Piggly Wiggly. And as the boss come storming up the steps, I said, I've got a headache. Conning myself. I was very fortunate. There were a lot of these jobs I didn't lose because people were wanting to help. Most of them not knowing how, but wanting to. As the years progressed, my drinking picked up. It became almost a daily habit, and then it did become a daily habit. Of getting off from work, rushing to the Elks Club to have a couple of drinks. Then we had a couple of drinks, and I took a half pint home. Then a half pint at the Elks Club, and a pint home. A pint at the Elks Club, and a fifth home. And pretty soon I was on the same treadmill that so many of you recognize. The merry-go-round on which you cannot get off. And at that point in my life, I kept telling myself, I am supposed to be having a good time. This is what I am supposed to be doing. This is the end thing. It's socially accepted to get off from work and have a drink. A drink? Perhaps. A pint at the Elks Club, another fifth at home, that's not exactly a drink. So like a patient I had in treatment here not too long ago, he kept maintaining that he only drank 6 beers a day for a period of 2 weeks. He stayed with that all the way through. Eventually I got in touch with his sister. What he told me was absolutely true. He only had 6 beers a day for 2 weeks. One thing was, he was drinking quart beers. And this is where I was. I was having a massive amount of alcohol and saying I was having a drink. And I see a few heads shaking. I believe you've been there too. During this time, things began. I should have recognized them, but I did not have the mentality to recognize them. The home life became almost unbearable. Financial problems began to pop up. And they were countered by resentments and hostility. Why should the bank want me to come there today and pay them an automobile payment that just happened to be 2 months past due when I don't even have drinking money? How could anyone be that unreasonable? So the hostility began to build, and the justification of doing what you wanted to, it built with being able to justify any and every action that was taken. It was not my fault, it was someone else's fault. If they'd get off my back, I'd be all right. Somewhere in the early 60s, 61, 62, there have been times when I wish I knew the date and the place, but I don't think it's really important now. I crossed over that invisible line, from which there is no return, and I was no longer a social drinker. I was an addictive drinker. I had reached this point as to where there was no going back to that high I used to know from a couple of drinks. The only thing that was happening to me at that given moment was I continued to drink, but I couldn't get that high. It was a downhill grade. I didn't do anything except get drunker and drunker and drunker, no matter how much I drank. In 1964, my first wife met a rather tragic death. She was epileptic, had a seizure, fell into the bathtub and drowned while bathing the children. I was on the carport drinking a beer. For the same person, I think the reaction would be pull back and take a second look. But not for the alcohol-riddled mind. That became nothing more than another excuse to drink. Poor little old me. And I remember one day, during a few rare moments of sobriety at work, I recorded the pastor of the First Baptist Church. He came up and put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "Snooky, I understand why you drink. You really had tragedy in your family." That was better than a license to steal. Because I went all over Floyd County telling everybody that Forrest Lanier told me I could drink. And I used it till people got tired of hearing it. Any excuse mechanism to justify that next drink. Don't take the responsibility for your action. Put it off on somebody else. These are some of the qualities of alcoholism. From that point on, I know I didn't, at that particular point, I was not interested in doing anything to change my lifestyle. Why worry about it? Somebody else would look after the kids. Everybody was going to feel sorry for me. And as long as I had this stuff going for me, why should I have to be responsible for it? I can stay drunk and they can say, "See, he's got problems." But we understand why he has problems. Perpetuating the disease. Carrying it forward. Getting up in the morning with that horrible feeling of I can't get out of bed today. But putting that one foot on the floor there and the thought immediately hits, where did I hide my bottle? Just one drink to get me started and I'll be all right. And it was during this time that I first came to the realization that I might, not that I did, but I might have a problem. But it was a very hesitant thought. And I didn't give it just a whole lot of place in my thought process. I might have a problem, but I could handle it. I handled it well enough to check into the hospitals on four or five different occasions for treatment of, quote, acute anxiety. You know, at that particular time, insurance companies wouldn't pay for alcoholism. So the doctors made it very convenient to treat you for acute anxiety. And I have never had a medical doctor to tell me I was a drunk. I've had them to say, "Slow down on your drinking and take this medication, you're going to feel better. And see me in 2 weeks if you don't." Furthering the same disease that I have. taking their pills during the daytime and then drinking all the booze I wanted at night and going back and say, Doc, these don't help. Some of the things that we do to justify our own existence. But at that time, I didn't know I was sick. I was too smart to be a drunk. After all, a drunk was that skid row bum that slept in the gutter, clutched to his bottle of wine in the doorway, bumming 35 cents for a cup of coffee. That makes up less than 3% of the 11 million diagnosed alcoholics in this country. Yet it's presented as the image of alcoholism. It's the other 97% of us who are like us here in this room, who try to work and meet our needs day by day. What is the profile of an alcoholic anyway? What do they look like? Ask a lot of my education classes this, and you get some of the weirdest answers you've ever heard. Generally, it's everything except me. An alcoholic is everything except what we want to look at it as being. Especially if we're in the throes of addiction without a thread of honesty in our body. After being in radio for a number of years, and eventually I achieved the status of station manager. How I did it, I don't know. Stayed there for a while, went into partnership on another radio station that bombed out gloriously. Found out my partner had a different set of books than what I had. And his names were on the checks. From there, I went into different types of things. I eventually floated back into radio and out of radio. All of this time, off and on, one drunk after another. Not giving consideration to the fact that maybe if I would just give a little, I could get help. I wasn't looking for help. I was looking up for a way to perpetuate my own disease, justifying my illness. It was not until 1976, after going through a whole lot of jobs, creating a whole lot of problems, family, financial, and otherwise, that I finally said, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. At that point, I had finished off a half gallon of vodka that day. This was about 3 in the afternoon. And it started on the second half gallon. But there was something different about that drink. I cannot tell you what it was. With that amount of intake of alcohol, I still remember almost every detail. Called 8 different people, I think it was, 7 or 8. And these people were all too busy to come help. These were the same people I had used before. And I couldn't understand why that guy who operated a one-man business wouldn't close up his business and come help me, like he had 4 times before. And I couldn't understand why these people said, go to bed and sleep and call me tomorrow. But I think at that given moment was the first encounter I had had with a higher power. Because out of oblivion came a name. A man whom I had not seen in several years. And the only thought I had of him was this man told me years ago that he had had a drinking problem and had attended AA in Dalton. One conversation that I'd had with that man. I called him. We lived out at Silver Creek at the time. And I don't believe I could give anybody directions to that house sober. But somehow I told Al how to get there drunk. Well, after making my last outreach for help, I had another drink. I decided it was about time for me to have a little nap. You know, during this time in your life, you know, we just lay down and sleep a few minutes and rest your eyes. We don't think of just pacing out and coming to. But when I came to, Al was sitting on the footstool in front of the couch. And I said, Al, I need help. He said, Al, I see you need help, but do you want any help? And you know, I never thought that there was a difference between needing help and wanting help. I think at that moment, I realized that many, many people had seen my need for help, but they couldn't help me because I didn't want any help. At that moment, I wanted help. Within an hour, I was in Northwest Regional Hospital, where I spent 30 days. I'd really like to tell you that I learned a whole lot about how to stay sober there, and I did learn quite a bit. But I was still conning myself. I was even conning those around me. All that old stinking thinking hadn't gone. And I remember after those full 30 days, now they didn't have AA, they didn't have an educational program, they had a group encounter session, as I remember, once or twice a week. Otherwise, the highlight of our day was walking the mills and having battle signs. And after those 30 days, and my team leader told me that morning that I was going to be discharged, I got on the phone. I said, honey, I'm going to come home this afternoon. Will you come get me? And there was a silence on the other end. I mean, it's a long pause, about an hour and a half worth, it seemed like. And I said, did you understand me? And eventually the voice came back and says, yes, I heard what you said. And then there was another pause. And I said, you will come get me, won't you? I was beginning to get a little frantic. She said, yes, I'll come get you. And I'll take you out to the house. And then we're going to decide what we're going to do with you. Now, friends, my balloon came down in a hurry. I was no longer that person who had gone through detoxification to make all these things good for my family. I realized at that given moment that it was up to me. And I had had this realization earlier in treatment. But at that point, I was still conning, trying to get things my way. And my way never had worked. When I left the hospital and did get home, somehow the family structure stayed together. And here again, I think a higher power was looking after us on that. I started having calls from a friend of mine to come to AA and put him off for, I know, 3 weeks, maybe four. I always came up with a good reason. This was in the month of May, incidentally. And I remember one excuse was that, Paul, I'd really love to go with you tonight, but I've got to pick the kids up at band practice. Band practice ended last football season. I was lying, and he knew I was lying, and I knew he knew. But still, that was an excuse mechanism. But after the third or fourth week, I said, okay, I'll go down there and see what's going on. Because at that point, I had come to one realization, still conning myself. I'm going to get Paul off that telephone every morning, and I'm going to get that neurotic wife off my back. So I'm going to go to an AA meeting. So I went, parked about halfway up the hill from the wrong group and walked down the street looking over my shoulder about every three steps to make sure nobody saw me going in there with that damned old bunch of drunks. And I got in there and it was everything except what I'd expected it to be. Here were people smiling and shaking hands. Sober. And walking up and saying, we're glad you're here. It's good to see you. And then the man who was to become my first sponsor walked up and put his arm around my shoulder. He said, son, I knew you was coming. I just didn't know how damn long it was going to take you to get here. Well, at that point, I figured that they were trying to tend to my business. Because I know now, I didn't go just to get my wife off my back and just to keep Paul from calling. I went to AA to learn how to drink without getting drunk. And it blew my mind to see these people who were there and serious about their sobriety and doing something to hold their act together. It was awfully hard to comprehend. But at that meeting, I found something that, to me, it's one of the greatest gifts I've ever received. I couldn't put a name on it that night. It took me several weeks to put a name on it. These people had a peace of mind that I had never known. They were not jumping ahead and working twice as hard, drinking twice as much as everybody else, just to maintain the status of it. These people were happy because of who they were and what they were. I know now you call it serenity. I call it being comfortable. I was also introduced a few meetings later to the true meaning of the Serenity Prayer. And I wasn't easy to sell on AA. I didn't join that night. It took me about 3 or 4 weeks to take my first white chip. And I wasn't too sure about it then. But I could not understand that these people were enjoying a life of sobriety. To me, it was absolutely no way to be understood that a person could stand in front of you and say, I will never be able to drink again, and I'm happy about it. That was totally unheard of. I couldn't fathom that. I was still looking for a way to drink. Since then, I ran into a little quote Abraham Lincoln made in 1862. And this pretty well falls right into the day at the time concept. That far back, he wrote that anyone can do anything for 12 to 18 hours that would appall them if they had to do it for a lifetime. That long ago, people understood what living one day at a time meant. He also said in that same little speech that I firmly believe anybody can achieve any goal if they want to achieve it hard enough. So from those first few meetings, I began to latch on to this thing that I wanted to call peace of mind, serenity. I was fortunate enough to get a good sponsor, a hard-nosed sponsor. When I got slack on working the steps, he jacked me up a little bit. But I really didn't have much trouble with the first step. I'd already admitted I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. Hell, I wouldn't have been in AA if that wasn't the situation. And I had come to believe that there was a power greater than me. I couldn't hardly buy that sanity bit, though. I couldn't hardly buy that I'd been insane. But yet, what kind of sanity is it that when you're drinking and you see a police car behind you, all of the rules, regulations of traffic enforcement flash in front of you, and you drive right on the speed limit, not under, not over, observing every road sign, not missing a trick, but that car don't leave right behind. Then you pull into the carport and he pulls in behind you. At that point, I knew the officer, and I got out, and I said, Sam, why are you following me? He said, are you all right? I said, well, certainly I'm all right. If you'll stay off my bumper, I'd be better off. He said, well, I thought possibly you might be having a little trouble, because when you rounded that curb down there, you put on your blinker. But we deny these things while we're drinking. But one of the biggest things I learned was how to be honest. to be honest with myself. And after that, I began to start sort of like myself again. I found out I didn't like what I had been. And when I began to like myself a little bit more, other people did too. And things became a little easier. I still had a resentment at that time because I could not understand with all my talents why these people were not beating a path to my door to hire me. Maybe they just didn't know I was unemployed. And then after I put in a few applications, I found out they did know I was unemployed. And they weren't interested in talking to me either. But I went back to work in a totally different field. A friend of mine who was going to run for the county board, having known I'd managed a few political campaigns in the past, hired me as a part-time employee in an appliance TV store so he could charge it off on his books as an employee working while I still handled his political campaign. Now, this sounds like alcoholic thinking, doesn't it? But he won. And after winning, I had been plotting a little bit along too, I have to be honest. I figured that if he won, I knew the job he was running for was going to take him out of the store a great deal. And if he was out of the store a great deal, it was going to have to be a necessity for somebody to operate that store while he was gone. So once he won that election, I was the only trained employee he had. We went from there. In 7 months, there'd been a second store purchased. It did well. Within 18 months, a third store had been opened. It did exceptionally well. All of this time, I kept going to AA. They kept saying, come back. Work your steps. Your plan for recovery. I wanted this peace and serenity I was beginning to enjoy because things were beginning to go my way again, which is a danger area for me. But I found out that what few things that had happened good in my life during this time period came as a result of not me controlling them, but of somehow a power controlling them. And little by little, I became willing to turn more things loose and let that higher power take control. And that is where I found the serenity and peace of mind that I saw at that first meeting. It came from stop trying to put a square plug in a round hole, turn it loose and let a power greater than ourselves handle it. All the things that I've been taught by you people have come true. I took that searching and fearless moral inventory, and it was tough. I started out, I figured I'd run through step four in about 20 minutes. I got out my legal pad and started writing. 3 days later, I was still on, I think, the 17th page, still writing. Called my sponsor, I felt about that high. He said, you fool, said you misread it. I said, all it says is take a fearless and searching moral inventory. Don't say put down all the bad things. Don't say put down all the good things. So together we worked it out. And after passing step four and five, things began to come easier. Because I was not controlling them. For once in my life, I had been able to let go and let God. And that's when good things started happening. Things that I had not visualized or even thought about. And I think this is what happens to all of us when we let go and let God. There are certain things we cannot handle. We'll make a mess out of them if we try to handle them. Like I mentioned a moment ago, it gave me the meaning of the Serenity Prayer. I apply it to my life every day. If I run into a situation that I cannot accept, that I cannot change, I get away from it. Because at long last, sobriety has become the most important factor in my life. I couldn't understand that when I first heard it. But I also remembered something I heard while I was in detox. The meaning of responsibility. We think of responsibility since we're about that high and you're responsible for this, that, and the other. If you pick up a dictionary, the primary meaning of responsibility is the ability to respond to a given situation at a given time. While I was drinking in the throes of addiction, I was unable to respond to any given situation at any given time. But if sobriety became number one with me, I could respond to any given situation at any given time. And all of these little jigsaw puzzle pieces began to fall in place. And I found out I was happy. I was happier than I'd been throughout my entire life. AA has given me something I can never replace. I was just reading late this afternoon, and had time to read the 24-hour book today. But if you've read it, endure with me here. I am part of AA, one among many, but I am one. I need the AA principles for the development of the buried life within me. AA may be human in its organization, but it is divine in its purpose. The purpose is to point me toward God and a better life. Participation is the privilege of the movement. I shall share in the responsibility, taking it upon myself to carry my fair share of the load, not grudgingly, but joyfully. To the extent that I fail in my responsibility, AA also fails. To the extent that I succeed, AA also succeeds. I think if anything can sum up what happened and what things are like now, it's on pages 83 and 84 of the Big Book. If there can be a favorite passage within these 164 pages, this has to be mine. Become known as the Promises, where the writers of the Big Book, talking about step 9 and the sincerity of wanting to overpower this incurable illness that we all have. And they say in here, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor will we wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see that our experiences can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will suddenly leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. You know, all of these things have happened. Things that I didn't know that could possibly happen. Things that I did not expect, things I did not deserve. But I think the last sentence in this list of promises tells why. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Thank you very much.